from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Protecting our rights is a matter of exercising those rights that we are granted. You will not get your rights if you don't stand up for them.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Will Morrissey, Professor Emeritus of Politics here at Hillsdale College, and author of the recent essay over at Real Clear Public Affairs, Self-Government, the American Way. We talk at length with Dr. Morrissey about that piece on this week's program. You can also find him online at willmorrisseyreviews.com for book reviews and more. Dr. Morrissey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Scott.
Glad to have you back. We continue, in fact, with another piece that you wrote over at Real Clear Public Affairs as part of a series they're running there. And this one is called Self-Government, the American Way. Take us back a little to 1776. As the Americans, as the new Americans are moving from governing as colonists to governing as an independent nation, what are some of those changes? What are the differences that they're going through? What are they noticing?
Well, one of the main things that they want to do is to become a sovereign, that is to say, self-governing people, rather than, as you say, just colonists of the British Empire. And in order to do that, they have to do two things. One is that they have to assert their rights, and the other, which is what we normally associate with the Declaration of Independence, assertions of rights. But they also very clearly outline 10 moral responsibilities, 10 duties that they undertake to honor.
What measures do they take to work to strengthen this new union that they've created?
Aside from the political and military measures that we're all pretty familiar with, what they do is to declare their independence, and they, in doing so, they don't just say we're independent. They give you a logical syllogism, a reasoned argument why we should be independent. What we are doing, explaining to, as they put it, a candid world, an unbiased world. In other words, what we are about in declaring our independence and fighting for it.
You write in this piece over at Real Clear Public Affairs that to understand American self-government, one should begin with the First Amendment to the Constitution. I'll read it. Never hurts to hear it again. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. So why do we start there?
Well, in this case, obviously the first thing you would start with would be the Declaration of Independence. However, in terms of the Constitution, there's no harm in starting with the statement of first principles that is laid down in the Bill of Rights. And the First Amendment, which is only the First Amendment by chance, happens to be a very good chance, a sort of a providential chance, you might say. And in outlining those 10 responsibilities in the Declaration, one of the things that they understood was that one of the main pillars of moral conduct, of duties, is religious belief and religious conviction. And so they do two things basically in that with respect to religion in the Bill of Rights, which is that they deny that there will be an established religion. That is to say, they're saying that there won't be a state church, mm-hmm. like the Anglican Church in England, the Catholic Church in France, Germany, which was then 37 different sovereign countries. Some of them were Lutherans, some of them were, in the South especially, were Catholic countries. They all had established churches. This was turned out to be a bad idea. They did intend to develop the moral character of the people with these established churches, but the problem was that committed them to the need to determine who was a real Catholic, who was a real Lutheran, who was a real Christian. What the Americans do, because their founding is based on unalienable natural rights, they say, essentially, you can be whatever religious confession you want as long as that religious confession does not involve you in conduct that violates the natural or civil rights of others. The other thing, though, is that it's not just a matter of avoiding a religious establishment. It's also a matter of giving freedom of religion, mm-hmm. freedom to be religious, freedom to be religious without fear of being persecuted. As long as you stay within the basic framework of the American regime, which is, as I say, natural and civil rights, you're okay.
Let's get to that second part, the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press. What did the founders have in mind when they're outlining this portion of the amendment?
The main thing they're interested in is civic freedom, that is to say, political speech. They're not interested. Today, people think First Amendment rights mean you can just publish anything you want. It's not really freedom. It's license, right? It's a kind of license to say or do whatever you want with speech or writing. Not so in the founders. Obviously, in the founders, there were pretty serious laws concerning obscenity. Just general restrictions on that kind of speech. Some states had laws against blasphemy. That's not necessarily a violation of freedom of speech. What is a violation of freedom of speech would be especially a violation of someone trying to clamp down on people for their religious opinions or their political opinions.
Talking with Will Morrissey here, Professor Emeritus of Politics at Hillsdale College. His piece is at realclearpublicaffairs.com. Self-government, the American way. And that third leg of the First Amendment, peaceably assemble and to petition the government. Why would they include this in the First Amendment?
Well, to peaceably assemble means, of course, to deliberate in common. Again, if the American founding is based on the principle of reason, on a logical syllogism like the Declaration of Independence, then people must be allowed to reason in public with one another. They must be able to address the people they've elected to govern them, and they must be able to criticize them freely in a civil way without fear of reprisal. And this is typical of the way political figures very often will operate, right? The temptation, if you're in a political position, is to try to clamp down on anyone who has the nerve to get up at a public meeting and complain about your conduct. And it's an understandable human motive that unfortunately has been expressed all too often in the course of human history. But that's what they're trying to avoid. What they want is true politics. Aristotle talks about political life on the basis of the family. The family is not the individual, but the family is the key unit in Aristotle. The founders would agree with this.
Final question for Dr. Will Morrissey. We talked about his piece in Real Clear Public Affairs. It's one thing to acknowledge and enlist these natural rights and write the amendment. How do we effectively then protect them?
Protecting our rights is a matter of exercising those rights that we are granted. You will not get your rights if you don't stand up for them. I happen to be on the city council here in Hillsdale, and I like it when people come into our council meetings and say things and talk about things. And it doesn't bother me a bit if people come in and challenge whatever it is we're doing. That they should do that. As long as they're doing it in a civil way and they're making substantive points, I'm happy to hear it.
Dr. Will Morrissey, Professor Emeritus of Politics at Hillsdale College. This piece, Self-Government, the American Way, over at Real Clear Public Affairs. And you can find more writing at willmorrisseyreviews.com. Dr. Morrissey, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we're joined by historian Arthur Herman to discuss his new book, The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni, or friends of Hillsdale, check out hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Arthur Herman. He's senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. You can find him on Twitter at Arthur L. Herman, and author of the brand new book, The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. Arthur, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
So how would you define these cultural characteristics of the Vikings, the Scandinavians? What do you mean by the Viking heart, essentially?
The Viking heart, what I talk about is, and I have to understand this is separate from the question about the Vikings themselves as being, you know, warriors and being marauders and so on. This was an aspect of life throughout Dark Age Europe at the time in which the Viking Age unfolded. And so it's no surprise that those were the skills that Viking heart was concentrated on, because it was the skills needed to survive in an environment like that, in an inhospitable environment like Scandinavia, you know, with the incredibly cold winters, scarce and meager resources. But what developed as a result of that environment is this extraordinary sense of community and shared cultural values that held the Scandinavian tribes, that held the separate Viking kingdoms together through those centuries. But also at the same time, a value that was placed on the freedom of the individual to venture forth, to take and assume great risks in order to bring back the goods, the services, the commodities that the community needed in order to survive. So you get with this, what I call the Viking heart, you get on the one hand a very strong sense of group identity, of solidarity, but also at the same time balanced by a respect for the individual who must follow his or her own path in order to benefit the community as a whole.
Why were the Vikings the ones to do this vast exploration? How did their activity help unlock benefits for all society?
Well, it really made it possible was the technology that they had at their disposal, which was the Viking longship, which had as a unique characteristics of a ship that was, on the one hand, strong and buoyant enough to survive oceanic voyages, but also at the same time had a shallow enough draft that it would be able to move from oceanic or sea voyages to running up the river courses and deep into the interior of the countries and communities that they preyed upon at the height of the Viking era. And combined that with the square sail, which gave them enormous speed and maneuverability at sea, and they really are the original expeditionary warfare. They're the original exponents of sea power, even in its modern form, and what domination of the seas and sea routes can really bring in terms of wealth, in terms of power, in terms of connectivity with other countries and other cultures. And really the sea routes, as I explain in the book, the sea routes that the Vikings laid down with those incredible voyages and expeditions become the sea routes that the future of the Atlantic system and even today's global economic order depend upon. They really lay out the sea routes and the trading routes that modern prosperity and the evolution of modern societies have depended upon ever since. They're really the precursors of globalization. And I think that's one of the main points about this book and about what the Viking heart was able to accomplish in its time and in its place.
Do you think that we see the impact of Scandinavians specifically on, say, the American spirit or the American personality?
I do, and that's really the second half of the book. The first half of the book is about the Viking Age itself, and then how that Viking Age was changed with the coming of Christianity, which had an enormous impact and reshaping, and really brings the Viking Age to an end with its ferocity and its ruthless violence and expeditions against and marauding expeditions against others, and really becomes really it gives birth to the medieval Scandinavian kingdoms. That's on one side. But then the second half of the book is how, as Scandinavia fell further and further behind the rest of Europe in terms of economic development in the 18th and 19th centuries, Scandinavia's poorest had to find a place in which they could build new lives for themselves and for their families. And so you had hundreds of thousands of Swedes and Norwegians and Danes who set off across the Atlantic in order to find a new life for themselves in the United States. And that's one of the important points about the Scandinavian immigration. It all takes place when America has already established itself as a land of liberty, as the place where you can go in order to carve out a new life for yourselves, to find arable land. This is what, of course, drew Scandinavians to the great Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
All those acres, you know, endless acres of land waiting to be cultivated and brought under the plow and to raise food for yourself and for your livestock and your family. It was unimaginable riches from their point of view, given the scarcity of arable land back in their homeland. And so they bring the skills with them from the frozen north, including, you know, lumberjacking skills, of penetrating into the great forests of the upper Midwest, in places like Minnesota and Michigan and Wisconsin, but also to bring with it that incredible skill set that I've been talking about, the Viking heart.
Arthur Herman, the book The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. Why do you think, then, that Vikings have had such an influence on our popular culture, whether it be sports team nicknames or TV shows or Hagar the Horrible in the Sunday morning comics? Why are we interested in these Vikings?
Oh, who could forget Hagar the Horrible, right? It is. And it is interesting, isn't it, how that manages to survive. And it's a perennial interest, and not just to people who are of Scandinavian descent. You know, my grandmother, who was Norwegian, who came from Norway just before World War One, and so on, she was always proud of her Viking heritage. And even Scandinavians today, who, you know, we think about as being, you know, very Pacific, certainly not prone to violence, in their daily lives or in their view of the world, but they take quiet pride in that Viking heritage. So what is it? And I think at the end of the book, I talk about the way in which the Vikings as icons, cultural icons, capture that sense that we all have of a appeal of having to venture forth into the world, to deal with unknown challenges, to confront a world that is in many cases very hostile, but in many cases provides opportunities to create new directions and new future for ourselves and for our families. And I think the Vikings really encapsulate that.
Arthur Herman, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute. Find him on Twitter at Arthur L. Herman. And the brand new book is out now, The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. Arthur, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's been a pleasure.
Up next, Dwight Lindley from Hillsdale's English Department returns for his occasional series on Victorian poetry. We look at Gerard Manley Hopkins. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Professionals from all over the world have been working remotely, and the hardest part is finding a great place to focus and get the job done. Drop-in Go Working at 155 Lake Boulevard East offers modern and clean workspaces, call booths, conference rooms, and secure fast Wi-Fi. Drop-in's pricing is pay-as-you-go, with bundles of hours as low as $3 an hour. No contracts, no obligations. Drop-in Go Working, 155 Lake Boulevard East, next door to Starbucks and Subway across from Waterworks Park. Drop in for an hour or more and try it out. Drop-in.mobi. That's drop-in.mobi.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
As restrictions continue to be lifted in Shasta County, many businesses are set to reopen, and KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and KCNR1460.com wants to help spread the word. So, if you are reopening your business, planning on opening a business for the first time, or are already open for business, KCNR has many advertising packages to choose from. Give us a call at 530-605-4565 and talk to a KCNR representative today. That's 530-605-4565.
Hi, my name's Nick Gardner. I have a show here on KCNR, Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. every other Sunday. The name of my show is Poke the Hornet's Nest.
There's no mountain I can't climb. There's no tower too high. No plane that I can't learn.
I'm going to concentrate on local politics mainly, but we'll talk about national politics also. You'll get the view of the common citizen here in Redding, California. And remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Maybe it's a good time for a new perspective about what's been going on in our town, in our state, in our nation. I hope you tune in and hear the other side of the news.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come. 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
These are unprecedented times, challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency child care, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To get an email every time there's a new episode of this show, or to find earlier episodes, head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Dwight Lindley, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Lindley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again.
Our occasional series on Victorian poetry returns, and today we speak of Gerard Manley Hopkins. What should people know about Gerard Manley Hopkins?
Sure, that's a good question. We should first say he, like many others, was on this trajectory where he went to private schools and then ended up at Oxford and was classically educated. We could say the same thing for Alfred Lord Tennyson, for Matthew Arnold, whom we've covered in weeks past. Something I should say about him is religion was more important for him. It was important for all of them, but there's some religious details that are important for Hopkins that we should maybe fill in. There was a kind of religious landscape I mentioned when we were discussing Matthew Arnold the other day, that a lot of people were losing their faith, especially mm-hmm. the educated classes. There was also there were different movements heading in different directions. There was, as I mentioned when I discussed Browning, there were dissenters and kind of evangelicals, lower church Protestants. Then there was also a kind of high church Protestant movement, which came to be called Anglo-Catholicism, still in evidence today. You know, Lutheranism and Presbyterianism were much more on the margins for England at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But then some of these high church Anglicans became Roman Catholic, and that's the story of Gerard Manley Hopkins, who left the faith of his upbringing and became a Roman Catholic and even became a priest, a Jesuit priest.
Hmm.
I mean, absolutely horrified his family and alienated him from them. So that's a bit of background. It's not, he doesn't write about religion kind of socially exactly, but there's always a kind of religious or theological framework for his poems. And really, I would say nature was at the heart of his poems, and but always nature as a site of encounter with the divine. One of his most famous poems is called God's Grandeur. And people who have heard any poems of his, this is still well loved of Christians who love poetry today, of all denominations. This poem, God's Grandeur, really I think catches his approach to nature. And I won't read the whole thing, but he begins famously with the line, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God," and then he goes on. "It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed." And then he talks about how humans are always trampling down nature, the world that is charged with this grandeur. They're trampling it down with not only with their boots, but with their industrial civilization, and using it up and squeezing it out and getting it dirty and leaving it filthy behind them and not really caring about it and missing the beauty of it and its kind of revelatory capacity. But then the end of the poem says, "And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, ah, bright wings." And so he says, nature is never spent. You still have the Holy Ghost hovering over the face of the earth, like you get at the beginning of Genesis, right? That's what he's thinking of. You have the Holy Spirit hovering over the face of the deep at the moment of creation. Well, Hopkins says, yeah, and that's still happening. No matter how much we tramp it down and we mess up the earth that we live in and miss, frankly, its beauty and its revelatory capacity, God still has it creatively in its hand and will remake it, and it will outlive our bad use of it in his hands. And so all of his poems are striving to find that kind of creative energy of the divine coming out in these little things of natural beauty, also human life, of course. But that's a big theme for him.
There were an analogy there to also perhaps religion. No matter how much we mess up our lives, there is still this opportunity for a refreshing and an ability for faith and for God to come and say, "It's all right, I'm still here."
No, that's quite right. And I think, interestingly, for Hopkins, he thought that those times when we're brought low like that, just like very much parallel to when nature is brought low and crushed, it's those times of low, when we're brought low, that we can actually paradoxically see the magnificence of God most, because we need it the most. Right? When everything's fine, you don't need anything. People pray when they're brought to their knees, And so I think that's an excellent parallel. So another theme, just going a little further, I already mentioned the kind of revelatory power of nature. He would say that it was the most specific characteristic little motions and actions of people, but also things in the world, that most revealed what they were and also God in them. So there's another famous poem of him where he's watching a bird, the kingfisher, fly, and he says, watching it fly, because the kingfishers have a little red and orange in their breast feathers, and he says when they're watching them fly, it's like seeing them catch fire, and it's in their characteristic motions these revelatory, powerful moments of transcendence flash through. And this is something that runs throughout his poetry in his experience of people, but also others. Let me just read a little bit of this poem. "As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim in roundy wells, stones ring. Like each tucked string tells, each hung bell's bough swung finds tongue to fling out broad its name. each mortal thing does one thing and the same, deals out that being indoors each one dwells, selves, goes itself, myself it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. So what is he saying here? He's saying that each thing in its characteristic action reveals itself, says, goes itself, he says, says, what I do is me. Right, it reveals itself in its action. We do this all too, he thought. The things that are most characteristically you reveal who you are. Action reveals the self. And then he goes on at the end of the poem to say, and it reveals the creator of the self. Like, it's in these moments that you catch flashes of the divine. And he ends by saying that Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces. So these little things about life, you catch flashes of the creator of that life, and it's in our greatest particularity that we reveal, you know, the things about us that are unlike anyone ever,
mm-hmm.
that we reveal the hand of the creator. It's pretty striking stuff, you know.
We have just an extra moment here. I haven't had the opportunity to ask this question yet. What do your students say about Hopkins when you teach?
Oh, they just become absolutely addicted to it. I mean, it's like a gateway drug to poetry. There are a few poets like this that I will just say college students, okay, are just in a place where this kind of vision really catches them because they're hungry for transcendence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, later on you get into the workaday world and you have to make a paycheck. And there are different times in your life for different things.
Yes,
but college people want to catch fire. They want to see what is so awesome, what is worth living for. Where are these moments that are charged with the meaning of everything? And so my students, I mean, swallow that down whole in Hopkins.
Dr. Dwight Lindley, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College, talking about Gerard Manley Hopkins in our series on Victorian poetry. Dr. Lindley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Jay Waldron. He's National Shotgun Coach for USA Shooting, and he spent time on Hillsdale's campus with many athletes training. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Nothing says hang on to summer like classic root beer float treats. At Black Bear Diner, they paired sweet root beer and decadent vanilla cream in a dreamy cream pie filling to make a root beer float pie, served in a graham cracker crust and topped with whipped cream and maraschino cherries. Grab one with your meal or box one up to go. Always shareable, always delicious. But hurry! Serve this month only at Black Bear Diner, 2605 Hilltop Drive, where you can always feed your inner bear. Dine-in, delivery, and carry-out available.
Black Bear Diner.
At the Wagner Law Group, their goal as a fire victims law firm is to advocate for those who have been victimized by Pacific Gas and Electric Company's negligence. The Wagner Law Group has been rated the number one fire attorney group in Northern California and has low contingency fees. So, if you or your loved ones have been affected by the Dixie or Zog fires, contact the Wagner Law Group today. Call 833-200-7111. That's 833-200-7111.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Commons Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide 3 delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Ready and Electric Utility, like more than 2,000 utilities across the country, is a nonprofit public power agency owned by the customers. This year, we are celebrating 100 years of serving the city of Reading. October 3rd through the 9th is Public Power Week, and we celebrate the benefits of living in a public power community.
These benefits include low rates and local control. Community ownership means your money stays right here in Reading. Publicly owned utilities like REU provide excellent service and work directly for the community.
Since 1890, Stifel has established itself as one of the nation's leading wealth management and investment banking firms by understanding clients' hopes and dreams, focusing on building and preserving wealth. Simply put, when you achieve your goals, we achieve ours. I'm proud to be a part of Stifel as a financial advisor. This is Susan Eastman, First Vice President Investments. Call today for quality time well spent. 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can email the show at radiohour@hillsdale.edu, radiohour@hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Jay Waldron. He is National Shotgun Coach for USA Shooting. Jay, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me today.
And we'll talk in just a bit about the wonderful partnership that is now in place between Hillsdale College and USA Shooting and our Halter Sports Center. But first, I have to congratulate you and USA Shooting for the tremendous performance at the recent Summer Olympic Games in Tokyo. 6 Olympic medals for USA Shooting. What about the experience itself? You mentioned it's been a different year. It's been a tough year in many ways. Tell us what you guys accomplished.
Boy, I got to tell you, it was really surreal over there in Tokyo, and just really super proud of the whole team, how they went over there and just focused singularly on getting the job done. With we had a ton of distractions this year, as everybody knows. We've been going through a lot of things in the nation, but the athletes were able to get to Tokyo and just really get focused on their job to do over there. And, really did a great job with it. And it's pretty amazing. It's one of our best Olympic showings in, quite some time. And Shotgun itself brought 4 medals out of 5 events. And I don't even know, how words can describe, the feeling of such a successful, moniker event.
To be specific, 3 gold medals in men's air rifle, women's skeet, and men's skeet, 2 silvers in mixed team air rifle and women's trap, and 1 bronze in mixed team trap. Jay, tell us a little bit about your job as coach. These are world-class athletes. They have trained, they have practiced for a large portion of their life. By the time you hit the Olympic Games or even, any of these big competitions, what's your role as coach? Are you looking for little things here and there? Are you talking to them about the mental side of things? What do you see as your role?
Well, I really think, at an event like the Olympic Games, it's to present an atmosphere and an aura, basically, around the team and build that up with the team. Not only the team itself drawing strength from itself being a team and, being good team members, but, just creating an environment where it's okay to win, to put it out there and to fail and just to, to be yourself and to go out there and do the best you possibly can. And I think that we were, super successful with that environment this year. And it just really allowed our athletes to, go out and, focus on performing and not really worrying about all the other little things around them.
Talking with Jay Waldron. He is National Shotgun Coach for USA Shooting. And USA Shooting and Hillsdale College now have a partnership in place at the John Halter Shooting Center, which is just a little off campus here in Hillsdale, Michigan. Tell us about what that entails. How are Hillsdale and USA Shooting sort of linked at this point going forward?
I mean, this partnership started in 2019. I came out here on a trip and the Halter Shooting Center was nothing that it is today, I can tell you that. I mean, it was a beautiful facility at the time, but Hillsdale College just had this vision of building this immensely world-class shooting facility, and it's a lot like the Field of Dreams, build it and they will come. And I think they had that dream of building it and we will come. And we came out and took a look and met the folks out here at Hillsdale and decided it would be a good partnership for USA Shooting and the college kind of jump in together and form this partnership, this alliance. And since that time, Hillsdale has just been going crazy on their range facilities in the last year and a half. Got to give a shout out to Bart Spieth on this for just putting his nose to the grindstone, so to speak, and bring those COVID times and getting the construction of the ranges done for the shotgun side anyway. And now we truly do have a world-class shotgun range, one of the first in the nation of its kind, of this, quality and standard. So it's really been, starting to grow, exponentially since that time. And this is our first summer out here, running events and camps and, having shooters come in and out. And I gotta tell you, it's just been a wonderful experience all the way around.
So tell us a little bit more about how USA Shooting is using the John Halter Shooting Center for training. Are there athletes here essentially throughout the year, at least during the warmer months here in Michigan? How does USA Shooting using the Halter Shooting Center?
There's probably a trifold way. One, we're running some big events out here. So we ran our Junior Olympic National Championships, already ran that event, and it was very successful. We have our national championships coming up here in September, starting on September the 6th and running through the 19th. So that's another huge big event. We're probably going to bring in a couple hundred people anyway with that event and all the extra mom and dad and all that stuff. So pretty big event and fun. We just concluded with our junior world team training camp, which was amazing to have Hillsdale behind us and helping us with logistics of running a camp for 30 shooters. It's a quite a daunting task. And it was very delightful to have a staff and crew and just the wonderful folks out here at Hillsdale helping support that. And not only with that, then we have some of our high-end athletes that just, come in and come out to train. Before the Olympic Games, we had several Olympians out here just coming in for a few days to get tuned up or just to talk and, work through a few things. So it's just, on all fronts, it's hitting on all cylinders right now with the relationship with Hillsdale and the range facility.
Talking with Jay Waldron, National Shotgun Coach for USA Shooting here on the program. You mentioned some of the camps that are taking place at John Halter Shooting Center here in Hillsdale, Michigan. And what is USA Shooting and how is Hillsdale helping in that effort to train the youth, to encourage USA Shooting or encourage shooting as an athletic venture among some of the younger adults here across the country? What's happening there?
Well, right off the bat, they have the Hillsdale College shooting team is functioning out of that facility. So that's one thing that's really started to grow, and that shooting team is really starting to be quite successful under the tutelage of Coach Jordan Hintz. And so that's one thing that they're offering for their students and their student body is that activity of the student shooting. Hillsdale also pushed what we're calling a JODC camp or a junior development camp this year that ran through Hillsdale College, and they helped facilitate all the money and the dorms and all the different logistics that go into that with putting on this camp. And USA Shooting provided the instructors and helped with some of the logistics on that side. So it was kind of a really good marriage between the two of us, and this allowed some not only just beginning shooters to come and experience the games, but some intermediate to advanced shooters as well. And then we just, like I said, finished with the World Team Camp for our juniors. Are getting ready to go to Lima, and what Hillsdale could help us with infrastructure there with dorms and transportation and just all these little things that you don't think of that really help make camp experience something special and to be remembered.
You can find out more about USA Shooting at usashooting.org and more about Hillsdale and the John Halter Shooting Center, of course, at hillsdale.edu. Jay Waldron, National Shotgun Coach for USA Shooting. Congratulations on the tremendous achievements at the Tokyo Olympics recently, and we look forward to continuing to see you here around Hillsdale and around campus. Thanks for joining us.
Sounds great. And if you have a minute, come on out and see our national championships September 6th to the 19th. Visitors are welcome to come out, check it out, see what's going on.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Will Morrissey, Professor Emeritus of Politics at Hillsdale, as we talked about his essay, Self-Government, the American Way. Arthur Herman, his new book, The Viking Heart. Dwight Lindley from Hillsdale's English Department on Gerard Manley Hopkins. And finally, Jay Waldron, National Shotgun Coach for USA Shooting. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including Arthur Herman this week, on the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com. Join Sue McClain weekday mornings from 6 to 7 for the Sue McClain News Hour, where you'll hear the up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, equal opportunity critics. From noon to 3, learn how to get out of debt with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal, local history, North State Now, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune in to Ben Shapiro, your local downtown radio station, KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
High Noble Safe Company, formerly known as Cold Steel Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane, is having a summer clearance sale. Save big on some of the highest quality safes around. High Noble Safe Company carries High Noble, Browning, and American Security, just to name a few, and features gun safes, home safes, and high security safes with stores in Redding, Roseville, and Petaluma. Delivery, moving, and repair service available. Call 530-223-5050. That's 530-223-5050. Or stop by High Noble Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Salato, broker and co-owner of the Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
Fentanyl poisoning is a growing problem in our community, but we can help do something about it. Join us September 18th at 1 p.m. at the Riverfront Park Amphitheater for the Decennium Giving Circle to celebrate a beautiful heart taken from our community entirely too soon. The concert is free, but there will be a raffle with prizes donated by local businesses and artists. So come on down, because we can all make a difference.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423 at Advanced Automotive.
I became a writer not principally because I'm in love with the idea of being a writer, but I'm in love with the idea of entertainment. I just want to entertain people. Lee Child.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our master today that we will be learning from is Lee's favorite author, Lee Child. Another Lee.
Yay!
All three different spellings.
If you are listening to this episode on the day that it airs, yesterday was my birthday, so I wanted to make sure we paired this one as close to my birthday as possible because I love it so much. One of my favorite things about Lee Child is his style of writing. He is blunt, he is forthright, he is known for the Jack Reacher series, which are technically a mystery, but he's just in-your-face, short sentences, and always keeps the plot moving.
Just before we started this record, we made the comment to contrast it with the Neil Gaiman episode that we just recorded, where all the quotes from Neil Gaiman tend to be a couple of sentences long at the minimum. And then we have Lee Child, where there are several in this list that are at the most 4 words long, and it just shows the difference in writing styles. And it also shows a little bit of the difference of target audience. Lee, you share a target audience with Lee Child. I do not, so I will always take some of his advice with a grain of salt.
So the first quote that we're going to get into here is something that you may have heard more than once already, and we're only halfway through the month. It's, "Reading is the only thing that prepares you for being a writer." Sound familiar?
It should, because Stephen King said it. John Green said it. I don't think we got a quote from Neil Gaiman to say it.
But I'm sure he has said it before.
Probably. You have to read. You're going to find this advice from any author, and if you don't want to follow it, that is up to you. But just understand that you are ignoring the advice of many, many great authors.
This next quote is specific to his genre especially, but I think it speaks to a lot of storytelling in general.
"The end of any thriller or mystery has got to be both surprising and inevitable for it to be plausible."
That is a hard line to walk. Especially because
yes.
He's a pantser.
Yes. Being a mystery pantser myself, I can tell you that this is a very hard thing to do because you don't want it to be obvious, but you also want your readers to feel satisfied. And if the ending, if the bow on top just came out of left field and there was no setup for it at all, your readers are going to feel robbed of the story.
There's that saying of the journey is more important than the destination. I really think that's true for structuring your story as a plotter, because we want to know that the bad guy loses and the mystery is solved and the good guys live happily ever after. We read the story to figure out how they get there, not if they get there necessarily.
Yes. So the next quote is short and sweet.
"Trust yourself."
That's it. That is all the advice from that quote.
But it's good advice to have. Knowing yourself and trusting yourself to make it entertaining is a huge part of actually succeeding. Writing selfishly, enjoying the process, and trusting yourself to make it work is actually a skill.
A lot of the times when I'm running into writer's block, or what I'll call writer's block, it's because I don't trust myself enough to write what I want to have written in that scene. And that keeps me from doing a lot of stuff. So this is a piece of advice that I personally need to get better at listening to.
This next one, I think, speaks very much to his style and his storytelling and his audience, and that's...
I love stories with fast, immediate, uncomplicated storytelling.
I don't think Tolkien would agree, but I... But I certainly do.
Yeah.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.